The Races of Britain by John Beddoe. Part 8. Norman French Immigration. We have now to consider what was the extent and character of the immigration from the continent which took place after the conquest. But while the political connection between France and England continued to be intimate and friendly, the most important portion of the evidence available on this subject is that to be derived from the names, and especially the surnames, of the English people during this period. This fact was, I believe, first pointed out by the author of a book called The Norman People, who was well qualified for the task he undertook by his industry and his extensive acquaintance with genealogy and heraldry. Unfortunately, he chose to remain anonymous, which perhaps lessens the authority of his dicta. But his work is valuable, though rather one-sided. For brevity's sake, I shall quote him as N.P. Immediately after the conquest began, a change in the system of nomenclature in use among the English. Hitherto, their system had pretty closely resembled that of the ancient Greeks. Every man had a single name, usually compounded of two elements, and the great number of such elements in use gave scope for very great variety in the names. Men might be known to belong to certain families, to be Mannings or Skeldings or Skirvings, and they might be distinguished by sobriquets or by the names of their fathers. But surnames, as we recognise them, were not yet in use. Even the names of the Judean patriarchs and Christian apostles had not begun to be admitted into this name system, in which, however, Thor and his attributes retained the place into which the Northmen had introduced him. With the conquest, as has just been said, a notable change began. The subjects adopted the Christian names of their rulers, most of which, after all, had been constructed on the same system as their own, though usually of slightly different elements, while others differed only by having undergone phonetic degradation in the mouths of the Neustrians. The faculty of construction, of putting together elements so as to form a new name, had, moreover, been lost by the Normans. The priests favoured the use of the names of foreign and of Judean saints. The new fashions spread, like other fashions, from the upper to the lower, from the free to the servile classes, and from the more central to the more remote districts. There were, it is true, some countervailing eddies of practice. The stubborn conservatism of the people of some southern counties made up for their nearer neighbourhood to the centres of innovation, and vague patriotic recollections may have had something to do with the survival of such names as Godwin, Harold, and Hereward, the last of which endured for many generations and apparently slipped ultimately into a fitly honourable station, with little but phonetic change in becoming Howard. Moreover, intermarriages were common, and we know from the case of Ordericus himself that they occurred among the smaller freemen as well as among the nobles. The husband would usually be the Norman. There must have been in England, from the circumstances of the war, a large excess of males among the Normans and of females among the English, and the women of England were renowned for their beauty and their skill in the domestic arts. And the mother's wish would often prevail in the matter of the children's names. Thus it was, we know, with Orderic, and thus too, if the story be true, with Torfrida the daughter of Hugh of Evermoo and granddaughter of Hereward, who married Richard de Roulos, ancestor of the Rollos. Matthew Paris has an interesting passage on these intermarriages and on the settlement of Englishmen in Normandy in his Life of Abbot Frederick of St. Albans. And there then follows a lengthy passage in Latin. This account seems extremely probable. We know that William promised his daughter to Edwin of Mercia, though he never carried out his engagement, and we know that many names of English form occur in Normandy in documents dating from AD 1180 to AD 1200. Such are Godwin, Farman, Fear, Vitine, De Waylon, and Stanilonda. No less than 28 persons occur called Anglicus or Longley, and there is a curious surname given as Sakesby or Sakesby, which may have been Saxby or even Shakespeare, as N.P. suggests. It would have been in keeping, too, with William's policy to reward his English soldiers with lands in Normandy or Maine. Burton Abbey, Staffordshire, may furnish us with an example of the spread of the fashion for French names by the early part of Henry I's reign. Of 3 great and 43 smaller tenants at that time, 13 had names of French and 33 of English form. As the subtenants of Robert de Ferrers and William de Sobenhale, 2 of the greater tenants, the third was Orme, a native, are not mentioned. It is unlikely that more than 2 or 3 of the 13 were really of French extraction, for Burton Abbey was remote, the estate was church land, and the district had apparently been little meddled with. 3 lists of names, very valuable for our present purpose, have come down to us from the 12th century, and I have thrown their contents, so far as names are concerned, into a tabular form. The first and second are the lists of house owners in Winchester from the Liber Winton, one dating from about AD 1115, the other from 1148, so that about a generation elapsed between the compilations of the first and the second. Even in the first, the French-named house owners considerably outnumber the English-named, and in the second, they do so by 2 to 1, not reckoning in either case the instances where one proprietor, usually a Norman noble, had 2 or more houses. The actual occupants would, without doubt, have shown a larger proportion of English names. It is curious that the number of persons without surnames, or more accurately without second names, for a great part of those we have were doubtless not transmitted, increased between the first and second survey. For this I cannot account, unless by the conjecture that they were mostly the sons of English men. The increase of trade names among the French named may probably be partly due to immigration of the trading classes from Normandy. The city was growing fast and must have been fairly prosperous in spite of the wars and anarchy of Stephen's reign, and Normandy was overflowing with population in the 11th and 12th centuries. But the point to which I would call attention is the number of French-named persons, 5 and 4.4% respectively, whose fathers are proved to have borne English names, while the converse does not occur in the first and only to the extent of 0.3% in the second inquest. In some cases, the English-named father actually appears in the first list, and his French-named son can be identified in the other. The third column, in the same table, is compiled from the list of tenants of the bishopric of Durham in the Bolden Book. Its date is AD 1183, or more than a generation later and then the second Winchester list. Yet the number of English praenomina is very nearly as great as in Winchester, being in the ratio of 24 to 5 to 25 to 4. The bishopric was far remote from France. It was a comparatively rude and backward region, probably not very attractive to colonists from the continent. The natives, we have seen, continued to be powerful and warlike. The lists of names of benefactors contained in the Liber Vitae Dunelmensis lead one to the inference that names of the old type continued in use there or thereabouts until well on into the 13th century, when they somewhat rapidly waned away and almost disappeared, more rapidly indeed and more completely than in the south of England, where the process began earlier and was more gradual. Possibly, this disappearance may have been a little earlier than has just been stated, or the later names of Anglo-Danish type may be chiefly those of people from kindred districts, the Lothians, Cumberland, Man, and the Isles, rather than of the bishopric. But in any case, the statement just made as to the comparative rapidity of the process holds good. Yet it did not depend on a rapid influx of new ethnological elements. There is nothing in the history of the period to suggest anything of the kind. There is not so much to be said on the composition of the list. There are still over 30% of persons without any semblance of a surname or soubriquet. The rarity of noble Norman names and of trade names is just what might have been expected. The prevalence of names of locality continues in that part of England to the present day. On the other hand, patronymics, now so exceedingly common in the north of England, seem to have been comparatively rare. Perhaps the rarity was rather in the pen of the writer than in the mouth of the people. One solitary example is given of the old Anglo-Saxon patronymic in Ing. Ulframing, the son of Wolfram, holds land under the bishop. In the return of military tenants to Henry II, in the Liber Niger, there are very few English names, particularly of tenants in chief, except in Northumberland and in the West Riding, and not many even there. We are, however, told by the author of the Dialogue de Scac, in a well-known passage, that by about that time there was much difficulty in distinguishing among the freemen between those who were of Norman and those of Saxon descent. This could hardly have been the case if the English of the upper class had in any considerable proportion held to their own names. There may, therefore, be many of genuine English descent in the list referred to, but this is rather improbable on other grounds. The effect of every political change at that period was to bring over a fresh swarm of adventurers from the continent, and any lands falling to the king's disposal were almost always granted to them, rather than even to the descendants of the original Norman invaders, now much mixed with English blood.
You're tuned in to Radio Stormer on the DailyStormer.com.
After all has been said, I must confess that my method is a loose one for the determination of the proportion of Norman or French immigrants to natives, but it is much less liable to objection when used to indicate the relative proportions of the foreign element in the several provinces or counties of England. It consists, as will be gathered from the tables, in summing them up, firstly, surnames which were certainly or probably imported, or being of French form, were probably first assumed within a moderate time after the conquest, or which actually imply in themselves foreign blood, as Picard and Champneys. And secondly, trade and official names of French form. And taking the total to represent the amount of the so-called Norman population introduced into England within the two centuries after the conquest. Any excess under the second head may balance the number of Norman families concealed under local names and patronymics. The resulting percentages will still, probably, be considered large by most of the listeners, but I am satisfied that NP is right in maintaining the existence of a flow of migration of the lower class of freemen from Normandy to England during a century or more after the conquest. I have already referred to the table of modern surnames. It is not quite so satisfactory as the medieval table, inasmuch as it contains rather too large a proportion of the upper class. The column gotten from the Bristol Offenders against Martin's Act is particularly valuable from the mixture of town and country labourers which it contains. The names of these classes, as a rule, do not find their way into printed lists. The Wakefield prisoners were all of English birth, and in large proportion natives of Yorkshire, Lancashire, and other northern or North Midland counties. The lists of the Society of Friends, in some respects convenient, are liable to the objection that they contain too many persons of single names, which are perhaps rare elsewhere. Thus the bearers of the French Huguenot name of Marriage, and the Anglo-Saxon one of Barrett, swarm in the county of Essex, and the Richardsons in the northern counties. The West Riding List, dated 1821, I owe to Mr. J. Knowles. It is an upper and middle class list, free from the effects of the immigrations of later years. The Wildon and Ravensden List of ratepayers, due to Mr. Mark Sharman's kindness, may indicate that the ancient excess of Norman blood still remains in Bedfordshire. The following are the inferences that I draw from the tables. The proportion of Norman or French blood in southern and eastern England in the time of Edward I may have equaled 15 or even approached 20%. It was greater than this in the South Midland counties, but less in East Anglia and in the western and northern counties, especially where free sukmen abounded. It was perhaps rather small in Kent, taken as a whole, owing to the nature of the land tenures there, which gave little opportunity to foreigners to get on the land. It was greater in Yorkshire, or at least the north and east of Yorkshire, than in other counties equally remote, owing to the devastation of Dara by the conqueror, having left openings for colonisation. The Scandinavian patronymic, terminating in son, was already the favourite form of surname in the north of England in the time of Edward I. I incline to think that it was not confined in its origin to the Anglo-Danish districts, but extended to some of the Anglian ones. Migration from the north of England to the south, and vice versa, except to great manufacturing centres, was very small until our own times. The absence of patronymics in son from the rural districts of the southwest is almost absolute. No complete amalgamation of the different social strata, nor even of the racial elements, has taken place during the past 6 centuries. In the 13th century, the great landowners and the upper class generally were still mainly Normans, though the foreign element had penetrated to the lowest strata. the villains, the farming communities, the ancestors of the copyholders of later days were probably the most purely English class, more purely so than the Cossars, labourers and poorer class of townsfolk. Nor do I think that subsequent changes have altogether effaced these distinctions, though they have gone far in that direction. The small farmers are still, I think, the most Saxon or Anglian part of the population in the southeast and east of England, and the most British or Celtic in the southwest. Was any permanent change in physical type affected by the results of the conquest, and if so, where and in what direction? The addition of 15% or 20% of a foreign element, or more correctly, the addition of 15% or 20% of a foreign to 85% or 80% of a native one, might be expected to produce a distinct and lasting effect if such new element were homogeneous, but homogeneous it was not. The prevailing types among the Galato-Merovingian military aristocracy of France, as well as among the mostly Scandinavian aristocracy of Normandy, were still, we have reason to believe, blonde and long-headed, and the remains of the Anglo-Danish one, with which they certainly mixed to a considerable extent, were a purer breed of the same type, which is still the prevailing one among the upper classes of England. The bulk of the immigrants, however, especially of the portion of them who filtered in gradually and peacefully in later times, would doubtless more resemble the majority of the modern inhabitants of the north of France. That is to say, they would be, in the main, a mixture of the square-browed, long-faced type, which the French ethnologists call Cymric, with the short, swarthy, round-headed type of Brocker's Celts or Celto-Ligurians. This last, being rather feebly represented here previously, would not easily merge. I think it continues pretty common in the districts where my name tables lead me to think the most Frenchmen settled. Short, dark, blunt-featured people are commoner, I think, in the South Midlands than in most other parts, and the small, swarthy, round-faced people whom Phillips met with so frequently along the Yorkshire Owls and who struck him by their contrast to the prevailing Yorkshire types may as well be traced to this immigration as to any early Iberian or Ugrian strain. I have not, unfortunately, measured many heads from the east of England, but it is a little curious that of 29.9 who had dark or darkish hair yielded me a breadth index of 79.85, while 20 with red, fair or chestnut hair gave me one of 78.06 only. Now, in the west of England, where my larger experience enables me to speak more positively, the broader heads go on the whole with lighter hair. I am disposed to infer that in the east, where French immigrants were comparatively numerous, they brought in, or at least materially reinforced, the dark, broad-headed type.
Tuned in to Radio Storm.